Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's MolDEV press briefing on Texas versus U.S. Oral Argument, or DACA. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you may have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. Please note today's call may be recorded, and I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to MolDEV President and General Counsel, Thomas Sines. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I am Thomas Sines, President and General Counsel of MolDEV, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and I welcome you all to this press briefing on the oral argument to take place next week in Texas versus United States. By way of introduction, Texas versus United States is a federal court challenge filed in 2018, some 6 years after Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, was announced and initiated by the Obama administration. In this case, Texas and 8 other states have challenged the legality of DACA. It was pending before District Court Judge Andrew Hanen, who is also a judge who earlier, in an earlier case challenging the 2014 DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans initiative, had granted a preliminary injunction. But primarily because Texas and the other states had waited so many years since DACA was initiated in 2012, Judge Hayne did not grant a preliminary injunction in this matter. So the case was pending over many years, and a year ago, in July of 2021, Judge Hayne issued an order granting summary judgment to the plaintiff states, Texas, and others. That was immediately appealed by the defendant, the United States of America, as well as 2 sets of interveners. One set, about 12.5 DACA recipients represented by MolDEV, and a second intervener in the state of New Jersey. The case has now been fully briefed on its appeal, and next week on July 6th in New Orleans, a panel of 3 judges from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals will hear oral argument about the issues in this case. There are basically 3 issues that will be argued in this case. The first is the very important issue of standing, namely whether the state of Texas has adequately proven that it has an injury, concrete injury, from DACA and therefore has the right to challenge DACA in federal court. With respect to this issue, it is important to note that the United States Supreme Court has weighed in recently on the very issue of state standing in a challenge by Texas to the Affordable Care Act. So there is new law from the last time this standing issue with respect to DAPA was reached by the Fifth Circuit in 2015. The second issue is a argued procedural violation of the Administrative Procedures Act. Specifically, this relates to whether the Obama administration adequately implemented DACA in 2012, or whether it was required to go to a more arduous rulemaking procedure. The third issue is the substantive legality of DACA. If DACA is not within the power of the president, then it would violate the Administrative Procedures Act on its substance. Judge Hayne ruled on all 3 of these issues, and they are all heavily disputed by the defendant and defendant interveners. There is no indication of when these 3 judges will make their decision. It will certainly not be next week. After oral argument, they will submit the case for their further consideration, decision, and drafting of an explanation of their decision. I would note that because of the posture of the case, There are three potential outcomes. First, the three-judge panel could affirm Judge Hayman's decision, which would leave in place his conclusion that DACA is unlawful. Second, the panel could reverse Judge Hayman's decision and conclude that instead of granting summary judgment to the plaintiff states, he should have granted summary judgment to the defendant and defendant interveners and concluded that DACA is in fact lawful, or concluded that the state of Texas does not have standing and cannot move forward at any point in challenging DACA. The third outcome, because this was a decision on summary judgment, is that the three-judge panel could remand the case, concluding that Judge Hayman wrongly granted summary judgment, precluding a trial with witnesses and evidence to be weighed by him as the trial judge. This outcome is perhaps most likely with respect to standing. At summary judgment, he would have had to conclude that the state of Texas faced no material disputes with respect to the injury it alleges to provide it with the requisite interest to challenge DACA in federal court. But if the three-judge panel concludes that he should instead have held a trial with witnesses and evidence on the injury put forward by the state of Texas, that is the most likely posture if that third outcome of a remand is what the panel does. But as I indicated, there is no time limit under federal law for these three judges to decide, and so we have no idea when they would issue a decision. It could be a month from now, it could be 6 months from now. There's no way of knowing for certain how long they will take to reach their decision and then, more important, write up the reasoning behind their conclusion. That could be even more complicated if it ends up being a split decision and one of the three judges determines to write a dissenting opinion. So next week, the case will be argued on the plaintiff's side by attorneys representing Texas and on the defendant and defendant intervener side by three different attorneys. The first represented by the United States of America. And important to note that the United States under the Biden administration is now a full-fledged participant in defending DACA. When the case was initially filed in 2018, the Trump administration was the nominal defendant and really made no effort to defend DACA, leaving it to the interveners to put forward the arguments to preserve deferred action for childhood arrivals. The other two attorneys who will be arguing next week represent the interveners, the state of New Jersey, and the individual DACA recipients who courageously stepped forward to participate in defending DACA on behalf of all of those, really the entire country, who benefit from the provision through DACA of protection from removal and work authorization. So it is now my great pleasure to introduce one of those who will be arguing next week, specifically on behalf of those individual DACA recipients who intervened first to defend DACA. My pleasure to turn this over to MALDEF Vice President of Litigation, Nina Perales. Nina.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thank you, everybody, for joining the call today. My name is Nina Perales. As Tom mentioned, I'm the Vice President of Litigation for MALDEF, and I'm one of the attorneys who will be arguing on July 6th in the Fifth Circuit Appeal of Texas v. U.S. I don't have much to add to what Tom has already comprehensively described, other than to say that when this case was filed by Texas and other states in 2018, we intervened on behalf of DACA recipients themselves. At the time, the Trump administration, Department of Justice, was refusing to defend DACA. And so there was essentially a lopsided lawsuit in which all of the people involved, the plaintiff states and the defendant federal government, were all in agreement that they wanted to end DACA. And so the DACA recipients who agreed to come into this case and take on the defense of DACA have been very strong and very brave in putting themselves forward with their names to shoulder the burden of defending DACA. Now that we are on appeal to the Fifth Circuit and we have a different administration, the government is defending DACA alongside us. So in this hearing that's coming up next week, we are representing 18 DACA recipients from around the United States. They include lawyers, they include nurses, they include teachers, and others whose stories have become the evidence of this case and who will make sure that the court understands how DACA has benefited the United States and the states in which DACA recipients live. And a lot of their focus is going, the focus of the argument on behalf of the DACA recipients is that Texas and the other states cannot point to an injury that is traceable to DACA, and thus this case should not be heard by the federal courts, because without injury, there's no jurisdiction of the federal courts to hear this case. And that's all that I have. So thank you again, Tom.
Thank you, Nina. And now we will hear from someone who really needs no introduction. He is one of the most recognized and acknowledged leaders of the battle, policy battle, to secure DACA and ultimately permanent relief through legislation on behalf of the class of DACA recipients and others. I'm also proud that she is a member of MALDEF's Board of Directors. She is also a leader with the Dream.us, which is the largest and most prominent provider of scholarships for college to DACA recipients. I welcome Gabby Pacheco. Gabby.
Thank you so much, Tom. First, I want to share how we, just 2 weeks ago, on June 15th, we celebrated the 10 years of one of the most successful immigration programs we have seen in the history of the U.S. And while DACA only gave its recipients a temporary protection of deportation, it also provided an essential lifeline in the form of a work authorization. With that work authorization, not only were DACA recipients able to legally work, many of them were also able to obtain a driver's license or ID. Many of us either don't remember or might take for granted how often an ID is used in our everyday lives. But for these individuals, getting DACA meant they can apply to volunteer, for example, at their local hospital, their children's after school program or PTA, or a United Way chapter. But other mundane things like buying a ticket for a rated R movie, entering a bar or club, sitting in for an SAT exam or opening a bank account, applying for college or entering federal buildings, all of this was important. And for me, just last week, I was able to use my ID to enter the hospital to see my recently born niece. I think it's important to also highlight that the average age of arrival for a DACA recipient is 7. And DACA recipients have called the U.S. their home for more than 20 years. Nearly all DACA recipients, 99% of them, have graduated from high school. More than 90% of them are recipients that are working, including more than 340,000 workers deemed essential, including nurses, educators, and those who kept food on our tables during the pandemic. Their contributions are estimated to be more than $11.7 billion to the U.S. economy each year. DACA recipients have maximized their opportunities in these past 10 years. About half of them, at least 47% of them, of all recipients have attained at least some college education. And I'm also happy to share that they also have found love and started families. More than a quarter are married, and nearly one-third have at least one child at home. Many are heading households. 300 of U.S.-born children have at least one parent with DACA. In a recent survey, the Dream.US did, we found that our alumni showed that 38% of our recent graduates are making more money than their parents' income combined. 58% of them have one or more family members depending on their income. Our survey also showed that this community is active in their own community. 47% of them are volunteering at least once a year in areas like youth development, mental health, K-12 education, to name a few. The American Immigration Council estimates that there are roughly 56,000 DACA recipients who are homeowners. That is 566.9 million in mortgage payments each year. And over 900 DACA recipients joined the military and provided valuable language and medical skills through the MAFNI program. Unfortunately, in 2017, the Trump administration ended this program. Now, these statistics pale in comparison with all the individual stories of dreams big and small fulfilled thanks to DACA. DACA recipients are our friends, our colleagues, family members, and neighbors, and they are deeply rooted in our communities. While we believe in the legality and the power of this program, we also know and understand that only permanent solution for DACA recipients, their families, their colleagues, and other undocumented individuals is for Congress to pass legislation that provides certainty through an immigration status that can lead individuals to eventually apply to become full-fledged citizens of the nation they've always called home. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Gali. So we are now open to questions. Chloe, can you see if there are questions?
Absolutely. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. And once again, to join the queue, that is star and one. And we'll move first to Alan Wernick with New York Daily News. Please go ahead.
Hello. I have two questions. If the court upholds, if the appellate court upholds a lower court decision, does that mean that those individuals with DACA now will be able to continue in that status and continue to renew? And the other question is, do you think that the decision on the Remain in Mexico policy issued by the Supreme Court will impact the litigation around DACA?
Thank you for the two questions. I will answer the second question, and then I'll turn to Nina about the first. So we are, of course, carefully reviewing the decision issued by the Supreme Court today, but on initial review, it is unlikely to play a significant role in this case because today's decision was based on a careful reading of a very specific passage in the INA relating to what happens to asylum seekers or what may happen to asylum seekers while they wait for an adjudication of their claim to asylum. So we will review carefully what the justices issued today, but at least initially does not appear to have a significant impact on what will be argued next week. With respect to the outcome, assuming that this three-judge panel were to affirm, particularly with respect to those DACA recipients, current recipients, who have not been affected by what Judge Hainan decided a year ago because he issued a stay of his own ruling about DACA's illegality. He issued a stay with respect to current recipients so that current DACA recipients have been able over the last year to continue to apply and receive renewals of their DACA and work authorization. So, Mia, can you respond to what may happen after this panel acts? Mia?
I'm sorry. It's really impossible to predict what the court is going to say about what happens next with DACA, if the court even decides to say what's going to happen next to DACA, because it's very possible that the court, even if it agreed with Judge Hainan, it's possible that the court could simply send the matter back to Judge Hainan to then ask the Biden administration to come up with next steps. For example, the Biden administration is working on a new regulation related to DACA that I think is rumored to be coming out in August. And so it is impossible to say at this moment what might happen next for DACA recipients and their DACA after a ruling by the Fifth Circuit.
Thank you. Are there more questions?
Yes. We'll move next to Rebecca Loyola with Telemundo 52. Please go ahead.
Hi. So unfortunately, it cut out when you were going over the three possible outcomes. I was wondering if you could repeat those 2 second outcomes.
Sure. So the panel could choose to affirm Judge Hainan with respect to all of his decisions, or a portion of them, still leading to a conclusion that DACA is unlawful consistent with his, or the court 3-judge panel could reverse his decision and conclude that he should have instead granted summary judgment to the defendant and defendant interveners, since that also was before Judge Hainan. The third outcome, because of the posture of the case, this was a summary judgment decision by Judge Hainan, meaning he concluded that there were no material disputes of fact or evidence that needed to go to a trial, full trial with witnesses, with documentary evidence that he would then weigh and explain how he weighed them. But if the 3-judge panel concludes he should have allowed at least one of the issues to go to trial, the most likely issue would be standing, specifically whether Texas has proven a sufficient concrete injury to be allowed in federal court to challenge DACA. If the panel concluded that that required weighing conflicting evidence provided by witnesses and documents, then they could remand the case, directing him to conduct a trial about the issue of standing, for example.
Thank you.
I might turn at this point, because the standing issue is so important, to ask Nina if she would briefly outline what are the injuries alleged by the state of Texas and that Judge Hainan determined they had sufficiently proven to have standing for the case to move forward. Mia?
Thanks, Tom. So one of the central issues in the case is whether Texas has suffered any kind of negative effects from having DACA recipients living in Texas. And what's become clear over the several years that Texas has had to try to prove that it's injured is that Texas doesn't have any evidence of injury to the state. And I'll talk about the kind of 2 categories that Texas is claiming injury in. The first category is that Texas claims that having DACA recipients in the workforce creates competition and hurts U.S. citizen workers. But Texas has been unable to point to any U.S. citizen who lost out on a job because of a DACA recipient, even though DACA has just celebrated its 10th anniversary. Texas has no example to point to of competition by a DACA recipient creating a negative effect for a U.S. citizen. Similarly, Texas has not been able to point to any employers that Texas says hired a DACA recipient instead of a U.S. citizen. So this first category of harm that Texas is claiming, which it calls labor market distortion, has not yielded any evidence. What we do know is that when DACA recipients participate in the workforce, they create more jobs through their work. And they also contribute with their earnings to their families, tax base, and many other positive effects of DACA recipients working in a state. Then the second category that Texas is claiming harm is that it spends social services money on DACA recipients. But again, Texas was never able to come up with even a single dollar that it could document being spent on a DACA recipient for example, emergency Medicaid or anything else like that. So Texas, again, although it started this case by claiming that DACA recipients were causing Texas to have to spend social services money, Texas was never able to identify a dollar of state money that went to a DACA recipient. And so that's going to be one of the pieces of the argument that you will hear on July 6th, is that without injury, Texas should not be allowed to sue, because really all that Texas is presenting is a policy dispute and not a real lawsuit.
Thank you, Nina. Are there more questions?
Yes, and as a reminder, that is star and one to join the queue. We'll move next to Julia Preston with the Marshall Project. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you for holding this call. Just following on the discussion that you just had, is the standing argument the leading edge of your argument? And if so, what other arguments are we likely to hear from MALDEF on behalf of the DACA recipients next week? And also, where do we stand? Is this the full appeals court, or who's hearing the case next week?
So, Julia, this is the first hearing in the Fifth Circuit. So, as you know, it is in front of a panel of three judges from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. We now know the identity of those three judges as of this week. And it is possible, as your question suggests, once this three-judge panel reaches a conclusion, that one party or the other could seek an en-banc review by all of the judges in the Fifth Circuit. So this is just the first step of the panel hearing and decision. I would say that standing is one of the two critical arguments to be put forward. The other is the substantive legality of DACA. In other words, is it consistent with the president's authority for him to have implemented DACA? Because it is a split argument, as I mentioned, there will be three attorneys arguing on behalf of DACA. The United States will have the bulk of the time assigned to the defendants. And then the remaining time is split between the state of New Jersey, which has also intervened, and Nina Perales, MALDEF's Vice President of Litigation, on behalf of the intervening DACA recipients, who initially intervened out of a well-founded concern that the Trump administration, which was nominally defendant, would not actually put forth a vigorous defense of DACA. So standing is certainly one of the critical arguments, and I think next week you will hear that Nina will be focusing on the injuries put forward by Texas, the lack of adequate evidence, indeed the lack of any evidence that is undisputed, which is required for summary judgment to have been granted. So that will be an important part of the argument, but again, important to note, three different attorneys arguing, and you can expect them to have different focuses, foci, in what they argue. Nina, did you want to add anything?
No, you've covered it, Tom. Thank you. Unless there's a question about who the specific judges are, in which case the judges are Kurt Engelhart, Priscilla Richman, and James Ho.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions?
We do have a follow-up from Alan Wernick with New York Daily News. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I do have a follow-up. So I just wanted to clarify on this question what could happen to the people who have DACA. I understand that the long term is not 100% clear, but if the lower court decision that is being reviewed allows DACA to people who have DACA to continue in that status, can you explain how the Fifth Circuit decision would possibly eliminate that benefit to the people who have DACA?
Sure. So the reason that current DACA recipients have been able to continue to apply for and receive renewals is because Judge Hainan, in granting summary judgment, also stayed or blocked his own decision with respect to current recipients and renewals. His decision did, because he did not stay this portion of it, prevent the processing and granting of new DACA to folks who had applied. It is possible that this panel, even if it concluded that Judge Hainan was correct in concluding that summary judgment should be granted, concluding that DACA is unlawful, the panel could do two things that would leave current recipients where they currently are. It could leave the stay in place with respect to current recipients, recognizing that there is likely to be further court review, either the en banc full Fifth Circuit consideration or the request that the United States Supreme Court hear and decide the case. So they could leave the stay in place until there's a final resolution in the federal court system. Alternatively, as Nina suggested previously, they could decide, despite agreeing with him about the ultimate legality question, to remand to Judge Hainan to allow the parties, and most importantly, the United States, to come forward with suggestions about how the issue should be resolved, the specific issue of eliminating DACA because it is unlawful. The reason that that is a, I would say, significant possibility is to remind everyone, the U.S. Supreme Court itself in the Regents decision in which it prevented the Trump administration from moving forward with eliminating DACA, the U.S. Supreme Court emphasized the reliance interests of DACA recipients, that they had relied on an understanding that DACA would continue. And that reliance included pursuing employment, pursuing education, that is dependent upon DACA continuing for those current recipients. That's why the issue of how to wind down DACA if the federal court system ultimately concludes that it cannot continue is a bit more complicated, because you do have U.S. Supreme Court decision emphasizing how complicated the issue is. Nina, did you want to add anything?
No, other than to say, other than to reiterate that any ruling by the Fifth Circuit is the ruling by the Fifth Circuit. but you won't be able to look at the ruling of the Fifth Circuit and be able to tell what's going to happen next with DACA, because it can result in different types of outcomes. So, you know, we're going to have to read the decision very carefully. Go ahead.
Let me ask the question a different way. There's a fear among people who have DACA, and I've seen it written about in a number of places, that there'll be a decision that will come from the Fifth Circuit, and that on the day of that decision, DACA will end for people who have it, and people who have it will not be able to apply for extension. Is that a possibility?
I would say, and then I'm going to turn to both Mia and Gadi, I would say that is unlikely for the reasons we described.
Okay, good.
Even when there was discussion earlier in this case about ending DACA for current recipients, all that was contemplated was allowing individual DACA to end with their expiration date. So there was never a discussion or consideration of today it ends for everyone. It was a process of winding down so that when individuals with DACA faced a renewal date but were unable to renew, it would expire at that point. So it wasn't a single expiration date. It was expiration dates triggered by each individual recipient's current grant of DACA. I would not expect that to be any different, but that would have to be resolved in some way. That's why Nina explained that it is unlikely that the Fifth Circuit decision alone will result in a clear indication of what happens next for current recipients. But I emphasize that as this had been discussed in this case previously, there was never any serious consideration of a single date cutoff for all current recipients. Instead, it would be a wind down by individual recipients, if that makes sense.
Yes, thank you very much. That's extremely helpful.
Okay. So let me then turn to Nina and Gabi if they'd like to comment further about this issue of what could happen when the Fifth Circuit panel decides.
I just want to note that one of the things that we have been telling current DACA recipients is to ensure that they are renewing their DACA on time. We know that there was some within the Department of Homeland Security during the pandemic and even some other times where there was some delays. And so to make sure that you are submitting your DACA application within the given time and to renew it so that in case that there was to be some of these outcomes that they'll have a renewal that will take them way into 2023, 2024.
Thank you, Gabi. Nina?
No, I don't have anything additional to add other than to say that when Judge Haynen's decision came out last July and he ruled that DACA was unlawful, but then he stayed that portion of his own decision and said that current recipients could still renew. A lot of people took just the first part that he had said DACA was unlawful, and we started seeing, you know, people saying publicly that DACA had ended. So I would just caution that there's going to be sort of two parts to whatever decision comes out in this case. One is going to be the formal legal ruling, but that's distinct from anything that the court might decide to do with respect to the continuation or not of DACA.
Are there more questions?
It does appear there are no further questions at this time.
Great. Thank you. On behalf of MALDEF and on behalf of our speakers, I want to thank all of you for joining us and participating today. Obviously, the oral argument next Wednesday in New Orleans in Texas versus United States is a watershed moment. It is the beginning of appellate consideration of Judge Haynen's decision, and therefore is significant. However, I emphasize, there will be no decision next Wednesday. The judges will take the time they deem that they need to complete their decision-making and issuing their decision and any dissent. I further emphasize that once the panel does decide, however it decides, there will be further court proceedings. There first of all is likely to be by either side an attempt to have further appellate review either by the full Fifth Circuit or by the United States Supreme Court. And putting that aside, there will need to be further consideration by a judge or judges of how to implement any decision that DACA is unlawful. And that relates to how you wind down a program that, as Gabby noted, has now been in place for a decade. So as important as next week's argument is, we still have many months to know what is the ultimate months and perhaps even years, assuming the U.S. Supreme Court were to grant review. We still have significant time to know the ultimate outcome with respect to DACA. And I have to also end by saying that all of us on this call, including the clients that we represent, believe and request that Congress do its job, and in particular, that the Senate, as split as it may be, do its job and act upon the policy desires of super majorities of American citizens from both parties to provide legislated, permanent protection to DACA recipients and those who are similarly situated. The fact is that there has been supermajority public support for the DREAM Act in its different versions to protect these classes of immigrants, young people, many of whom are now DACA recipients, but many of whom are not. But there is supermajority support for Congress to do its job to provide long-term relief. And with that, I thank you all again, and we look forward to talking further next week. Have a good evening.